This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Penetrating and perfect karma is rarely met with, even 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to. To remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. It's nice to be here again. Many years ago, I attended a lecture on the Vimalakirti Sutra in Monterey by, I think his name was Lou Richman? Yeah. Is that his name? Yeah, and he was saying, he was talking about applying Zen practice to driving a car, and he said that he didn't know what Dogen would have thought about him doing that, but he said, Dogen's not here, I am. So here I am, a Nichiren Shu minister in a Zen temple, being asked to give a talk about Pure Land Buddhism. So I don't know what the founder of my lineage, Nichiren, would have thought of that, but Nichiren's not here, I am. So we'll proceed. Reverend Myo asked me if I could give a talk about the devotional traditions in East Asian Buddhism, and primarily that means Pure Land Buddhism. Some people like to lump Nichiren Buddhism into that as if it were just an outgrowth or a variation of Pure Land Buddhism. I strenuously object to that. I think that Nichiren Buddhism is very much a reaction against Pure Land Buddhism, though it is devotional. But it's not just devotional, so we'll get into that. Hopefully, I'll have time to get into that. So this is going to be a little more scholastic and more books than I'm, you know, want to give. I usually like talking more off the cuff and not throwing a lot of quotes out at people. I used to do that many years ago and I've been trying to get away from it, but I don't think it can be avoided in this case. I'm going to go a little fast. I'm going to throw out a lot of names and dates. There will be no pop quiz. I think the important thing is just going to take in that there's this whole vast tradition that is actually the mainstream of East Asian Buddhism that Americans really just don't know about. And I think it's important that we do know about it, even if you're not a practitioner of those forms of Buddhism, because it is so important. And it is part of the Zen tradition as well, that there are several points of intersection. So, enough of that rambling. I will now get into it. Let's see, here's my little, there it is. The first thing I think to cover is the Pure Land Sutras. And there's many, many Mahayana sutras that talk about Pure Land devotionalism, several relating to Amitabha Buddha, the Buddha of infinite light and life, others related to other Buddhas, Medicine King, Kshobya, and so on and so forth. There's four that I really think need to be covered here. And the first thing, well, I guess even before I talk about them, I was at the lecture Reverend Myo gave on Thursday night at Zen Center, and he briefly alluded to when Buddhism came into China. The legend that I'm familiar with, and I stress legend, is that it came in the year 67 of the Common Era, the latter Han Dynasty, when Emperor Ming supposedly had a dream of a golden man floating above his garden. And when he awoke, he told the dream to his counselors, and they said, well, a great sage was born far off in the west, by which they meant India. So he sent 18 envoys there, and two monks returned, bearing statue of the Buddha and sutras and other things, and on a white horse. And so the Emperor Ming established the White Horse Temple. So that's the legend. I'm sure the truth is more that, you know, trade was going back and forth along the Silk Route. Probably merchants who were Buddhist had come in before that, may have been talking about things with people. Perhaps, you know, some monks had wandered into China earlier than that. But in any case, this charming little story is just a way of kind of creating a fictionalized account of how it might have come in around that period of time. After that, for the next few centuries, sutras began to be translated. So one of them was, I guess I might need my reading glasses, let's see, the Pratyutpanna Sutra. And forgive me if I'm not pronouncing Sanskrit or Chinese names right, I do the best I can. the Pratyupana. In English, you could render that as a sutra of the samadhi to behold all the present Buddhas. And this is translated around the 2nd century. And this sutra will figure prominently in early Pure Land strains in China and in Tiantai Buddhism. Another early sutra that was translated was the Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, usually rendered in English as a Sutra of the Buddha of Infinite Light, or life, even though Sukhavati Vyuha means the Pure Land of Bliss. That was translated around the 2nd century, and in that sutra it tells a story of a bodhisattva named Dharma Store, or Dharma Treasury. Let's see, where do I have that? Page 33 in here. Give me a second. There we go. Yes. Dharmakara. That was it. Dharma Treasury. Dharmakara. Bodhisattva who makes 48 vows to create the best of all pure lands, taking elements from all the pure lands of all the Buddhas in the 10 directions of the universe, because, you know, in the Pali Canon version of Buddhism, they don't talk about Buddhas in other worlds. They don't say there's not any either. They just don't talk about it. There's Shakyamuni Buddha of this world. That's all you need to worry about. And then Maitreya is waiting in the wings in the Tushita heaven. He'll come later. He's the only bodhisattva we need to even think about. But don't think about him too much. Come back to the Four Noble Truths and all that. But Mahayana said, well, you know, if the Buddha's gone, we no longer have the influence of the Buddha. We no longer can appeal to a living Buddha. And that's really terrible, especially if we're going to make these vows to be bodhisattvas and we'll be reborn in various places trying to build up our wisdom and merit. So maybe there's some other Buddhas out there somewhere. So they thought, well, if there's only one Buddha per world system, per dispensation of the Dharma, maybe there's worlds out there where that's still going on. So there's all these worlds in the 10 directions throughout the universe where they have their one Buddha on that world during his dispensation. And maybe some of these have longer lifespans than the Buddha. So that's where you get Amitabha and all these others. And the Bodhisattva becomes Amitabha is this Dharma treasure, Dharmakara, who makes vows to take in the best of all the different pure lands, mold them into one, and make vows that anyone who calls upon him or thinks of him can be reborn there. In particular, the 18th of these 48 vows became very, very important to the Pure Land tradition as it developed later in China, Korea, Japan. The 18th vow reads, "If, when I attain Buddhahood, sentient beings in the lands of the 10 directions who sincerely and joyfully entrust themselves to me, desire to be born in my land, and call my name, or in some translations, think of my name." Nian Fo means either calling on or thinking of the Buddha. "Even 10 times should not be born there, may I not attain perfect enlightenment. Excluded, however, are those who commit the 5 gravest offenses and abuse the wonderful Dharma." 5 gravest offenses being killing your father, mother, an arhat, creating dissension in the Sangha, wounding a Buddha.
Michael, excuse me for interrupting. Yeah. Just in case, would you just briefly say, how do we understand what a pure land is?
Oh, yes, of course. In Pali Buddhism, or you know, pre-Mahayana Buddhism, there are all these heavens stacked up on top of one another. And if you became a non-returner, meaning you had gotten rid of defilements to the point where you weren't quite there to be an arhat, you know, perfectly cutting off all rebirth, but you're almost there, you could be reborn in one of these very high heavens. It's called the abode of purity or something like that, where you could just kind of finish. So you wouldn't be reborn down in the lower heavens or in the realm of the humans or much less, you know, like hungry ghost or hell realms. You would just go there and finish off. I believe this evolved into the idea of the Pure Lands in Mahayana Buddhism, where a Buddha would purify his sort of field of influence and make that world into a place where all the conditions were perfect for attaining Buddhahood. So it's not, Pure Land's not like the Christian heaven where you go there and you live forever. It's more like, I guess you could call it a graduate school or finishing school for bodhisattvas. But in the case of this 18th vow of Amitabha Buddha, this is not even a place where advanced bodhisattvas, or you need to be an advanced bodhisattva to go. If you're just an ordinary schlub, you know, mucking around in the 6 lower realms, you call upon his name, bang, you go there, and can immediately finish. Or, according to some of the vows, then become a great bodhisattva who returns into the realms, the lower realms, and helps other beings to be born there. This sutra also is a passage that says, even after all the other sutras have disappeared, this one will last 100 years longer. It says, In the future, Buddhist scriptures and teachings will perish, but out of pity and compassion, I will especially preserve this sutra and maintain it in the world for 100 years more. These beings that encounter it will attain deliverance in accordance with their aspiration. And that's supposed to be Shakyamuni Buddha telling Ananda this in this particular sutra. So these two passages become very important later on. Another sutra that was... this one was translated in the 5th century. There is no Sanskrit copy. So, you know, it might be a Chinese invention or simply that nobody's found the Sanskrit yet. It's called the Sutra of Meditation on the Buddha of Infinite Life. This one tells the story of when the Buddha's supporter, King Bimbisara, was overthrown by his son, Ajatashatru, Prince Ajatashatru, and was being starved to death in prison. And the wife of Bimbisara, Queen Vaidehi, tried to smuggle food into him, was caught, almost killed by Jatashatru, except that the physician, Jivaka, told him, if you kill your own mother, no one will respect you, and there will be rebellion. So he locks her in a tower. And while she's locked in the tower in despair, she calls to the Buddha, I guess out the window or something, you know, how can I deal with a world where all this kind of thing goes on? And the Buddha, with Mahakashyapa and Shariputra or Moggallana, let's see. Well, anyway, the Buddha appears to two of his disciples and then tells her about the Pure Land of Amitabha Buddha and gives her a set of 16 visualization practices so that she can make a connection, you know, a karmic affinity there and be reborn there after death. So this plays into the Pure Land idea as well of Amitabha Buddha and his vow. The next sutra that was translated in the 5th century is the just simply called the Pure Land Sutra, and it was translated by Kamarajiva, as I said, in the 5th century. And that one's very short, it's just a couple pages or so in English translation, and it talks about the merits of simply calling upon the name of Amitabha Buddha. So these three Pure Land Sutras, the Buddha of Infinite Life, the Sutra of Meditation on the Buddha, and the Pure Land Sutra that I just explained, would later overshadow the Pratyutpana Sutra, which more emphasized visualization practices, and they would be called the Triple Pure Land Sutras. And these were especially popularized by three Chinese teachers. Skip ahead here. Their names were, and I'm just going to pretend I know how to pronounce these. Or is it 38? Oh, yes. Tan Luan, who lived in the 5th to 6th century. Dao Cho, who lived in the 6th to 7th century. And Shan Dao, who lived in the 7th century. And these people especially focused on the Triple Pure Land Sutras and also some commentaries that were attributed to Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu. I want to say something about that real quick. Nagarjuna, hopefully you're all familiar with Nagarjuna, 2nd, 3rd century. He, of course, is known for writing the verses on the Middle Way in the Majjhimaka school. But in East Asia, he's also known as a Pure Land devotee. And supposedly he wrote, what is it? The commentary on the Ten Stage Sutra, which is a chapter, let's see what page do I want, yes, which is a chapter in the Flower Garland Sutra. And in the course of this commentary, he writes that there is a way of difficult practice to attain enlightenment through self-cultivation and a way of easy practice to attain enlightenment by thinking of and calling upon the names of the Buddhas of the Ten Directions. And here he diverts over the Pratyutpana Sutra. Vasubandhu, who lived in the 4th century, wrote hymns of aspiration for birth in the Pure Land, and with an auto commentary, these verses were known as the Discourse on the Pure Land. And in there, he especially emphasized the 18th vow of Amitabha Buddha, which I read earlier. So these two commentaries attributed to the great Mahayana patriarchs Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu became very important in the kind of lineage that was being constructed for Pure Land Buddhism by the followers of Tan Luan, Dao Cho, and Shan Dao. Now, let me set them aside for a little bit. I'll come back to them when I start to talk about Japan. In the meantime, one of the earliest Pure Land patriarchs, although it's not the kind of Pure Land Buddhism that's popular today in East Asia, was Hui Yuan. Hui Yuan lived from the 4th to the 5th century, died in 416, and created a group called the White Lotus Society, which basically was a little club, or maybe you could call it a salon, of lay people and monks who got together to devote themselves to the practice of the Pratyutpana Sutra, with the visualization and meditation on the Buddha, as well as chanting the name of the Buddha. But it wasn't just about chanting the name. It was a full-blown meditation, visualization practice. And they also followed the precepts. They were strict vegetarians. They were world renouncers. This is not the kind of free and easygoing Pure Land you find today in Japan. And, you know, among some Chinese and Korean, maybe lay people. But this died out with his death, although the idea of the White Lotus Society existed for a long time. And I think some rebel groups against the Ming Dynasty, or the Manchus, would later take up the mantle of the White Lotus Society, and it became something less religious and more political and kind of right-wing, I guess. But that's a different story. Now, another person to take up the practice of the Pratyutpana Sutra was Tiantai Jur'i, the founder of the Tiantai School, which is immensely influential. And has many points of intersection with Zen as it developed in China. He lived in the 6th century, and he wrote a work called The Great Concentration and Insight. And in that volume, he talks about four different kinds of samadhi, four different kinds of meditation practice, all sitting, all walking, half sitting, neither walking nor sitting. And the all sitting is basically sitting in meditation, practicing shamatha vipassana, tranquility and insight. Although the way he talks about it, I believe, spills over into the way it's talked about in Zen, especially the kind of more advanced practices he speaks of, where you directly turn the light within and abide in purity of the purity of basically subject and object, not having anything substantial. Although for him, the point was always to hold in tandem the idea that things are empty, but they're also provisionally existent, and that is the middle way. And there's no contradiction between these two sides. And to be able to see that all at once, and whatever you are encountering or confronting, is how one attains awakening in the Tiantai system, or is an expression of, I guess, awakening in words in Tiantai system. Although he also says it is inconceivable, non-conceptual, uncontrived. I could go on forever talking about Tiantai, so I'm going to stop with that. But in the practice of all sitting, he says that if one starts to get tired or there's too many deluded thoughts, one should then take up the practice of chanting the Buddha's name. And he recommends the name Amitabha Buddha. In the all walking meditation, one circumambulates a statue of Amitabha Buddha while chanting his name and visualizing the Buddha. And this is all based on the Pratyutpana Sutra. However, and here I want to get into a quote, there's more to it than that. He says not only should one think of all the, you know, the 32 marks of Amitabha Buddha and the glories of the Pure Land and all that, but one should also remember that it's all empty. There's nothing to grasp there. And then he goes even deeper. And I want to read some of this so you can get kind of a sense of it. This page, let's see, Austin. 246. When he talks about each of these practices, he talks about them in terms of what your body should be doing or not doing, what your speech should be or not be, and what you should or should not be doing with your mind. So this is the part where he's talking about mind. He says, "When think to yourself, whence comes the Buddha that I see before me? From nowhere. He does not come here, and neither do I go off elsewhere to see him. Whatever I think of, I see. It is my mind that creates the Buddha. It is my mind itself seeing the mind that sees the mind of the Buddha. This mind or thought of the Buddha is my own mind seeing the Buddha. Mind does not itself know mind. Mind does not itself see mind. When there are thoughts in the mind, it is the deluded mind, while having no thoughts is nirvana. The Dharma cannot ultimately be indicated in words, for such efforts are all products of thought, Thus, even when there are thoughts present, they are to be understood as empty and inexistent. And he goes on in that vein. So you could see there's more here than just, you know, pious devotion and hoping for a literal meeting with a literal Buddha in a literal Pure Land, at least in the Tintai tradition. Others who took up this kind of practice were actually Zen masters like the third patriarch, Dao Xin. Andy Ferguson talks about this in his book, and I wanted to share a little bit of that. 28 to 30. Dao Xin appears to have, his full name, Da Yi, or maybe it's Da Yer, Dao Xin, 580-651, the third ancestor. He was a student of the third ancestor. He's the fourth ancestor. He may have been the first to mix Bodhidharma Zen with other popular Buddhist traditions and thus broadened its appeal. The modern Buddhist teacher and scholar Yin Sun states that Dao Xin, influenced in particular by the Sanlun, that's basically the Majjhimaka school, and Tiantai Buddhist schools, made three contributions to Zen that have remained vital parts of the tradition since his time. These contributions were the unification of Zen practice with the acceptance of Bodhisattva precepts, the unification of the teachings of the Lankavatara Sutra with those of the Mahaprajnaparamita literature, which includes the Heart Sutra and Diamond Sutra, and three, the incorporation of chanting, including chanting the names of Buddha, or the name of Buddha, into Zen practice. He also says, or Andy Ferguson says, the effect of Dao Xin's teaching was to equate chanting the Buddha's name with Zen practice. This may seem strange, given that Zen practice is otherwise defined as observing mind, or meditating on its nature. Yet an imprecision in a Chinese language facilitated the odd unity of what otherwise seems divergent means of practice. The two-word Chinese compound nianfo, in Japanese that's nimbutsu, by the way, has two meanings, namely one, to think of the Buddha without speech or sound, and two, to chant Buddha, in other words, to chant Buddha's name. Thus, the phrase could apply to either silent meditators or to persons chanting the Buddha's name either singularly or in unison. This wordplay thus serves to unite different practices using the same terminology. Jing Jue quotes Dao Xin to say, "The essential practice of my practice, is in accordance with the Lankavatara Sutras, the mind of all Buddhas is the first principle, and also in accordance with the Prajnaparamita Sutra expounded by Manjushri's single practice samadhi, which is that those who think, Nianfo, of Buddha mind are themselves Buddhas, while those who think deluded thoughts are ordinary people." He was not the first, he was maybe the first, but he was certainly not the last Zen master to incorporate the practice of Nianfo, or thinking of, or even calling on the Buddha's name. Later on, Yong Ming in the 10th century incorporated this kind of practice, and another one was Chu Hung in the 17th century. And also in Japan, there is a third school of Zen in Japan. There's, of course, Soto and Rinzai, but there's also the Obaku school that's not so well known that came in the 17th century during the Edo period, or the, trying to think of the shogun that was. Well, anyway, during so-called modern Japan, or as modern Japan was becoming modern Japan, and these sort of Johnny-come-latelys of Chinese Zen come into Japan, and their form of Buddhism that they brought in also used Nembutsu. Whereas prior to that, the Pure Land schools and the Zen schools kind of more or less kept to themselves. At least that's my understanding. Maybe an exaggeration. But they had fully, this Obaku school had fully incorporated chanting Nembutsu into their Zen practice, which was typical in Chinese Buddhism by that time. Now getting to Japan. How am I doing on time?
It's 10:45, so...
Okay, I'll try to wrap this up real quick. In Japan, a Tendai monk named Honen, lived from 1141 to 1212, read the writings of Shan Dao, that earlier patriarch I talked about, and really focused on that. To him, he had tried all the Tendai practices and meditation and esoterica and everything else, was still the same lousy person he was that he started off as, and he figured the only thing he could do was just fully entrust himself to Amitabha Buddha, and especially the 18th vow. Some of his successors were Yipeng, 1239 to 1289, Yipeng's Ji, or timely school, because I guess the idea was now is the time to chant Nembutsu and let go of all the other practices. It was very popular until maybe the 16th century when the Tokugawa shogunate, that was it, the Edo period of Tokugawa shogunate, began giving their patronage to the school of Shinran, who was a disciple of Honen. Shinran went even further than Honen. Honen said that one should discard, abandon, close all the other practices. He says this in his Senchakushu, or Selection of the Nembutsu. That, you know, if you cling to all that, you're still clinging to your own self-practice. You're clinging to your own willful nature, which is the problem in the first place. You need to fully entrust Amitabha Buddha, so just chant his name. But Shinran says even that is still clinging to self a little bit, that the practice of Nembutsu is not even a practice at all. It is just all a gift from Amitabha Buddha. If you are fully convinced in your mind and have this deep faith that Amitabha has saved you, there's nothing left to do except be grateful. And the expression of that faith and gratitude is the Nembutsu. So it's not a practice to attain the Pure Land. It is a practice because you have been given that attainment by the Buddha. That's Shinran's position. I had a couple quotes I wanted to share from him, from his Tanisha. This is the Tanisha, it's the whole thing. Pure Land Buddhists don't even bother to read this today in Japan. It's an amazing document, and it's not long, it's not complicated, it's very profound, and it drives me nuts that nobody reads it. And I say that as a Nichiren Buddhist, you know. Here, let me just share a couple of these. The third passage, he says, even the good person, this is Shinran speaking, by the way, even the good person attains birth in the Pure Land. How much more so the evil person? But the people of the world constantly say, even the evil person attains birth. How much more so the good person? Although this appears to be sound at first glance, it goes against the intention of the primal vow of other power. That's the 18th vow. The reason is that since the person of self-power, being conscious of doing good, lacks the thought of entrusting the self completely to other power, in other words, is not letting go of the self, he or she is not the focus of the primal vow of Amida. In other words, they don't get it yet. But when self-power is turned over and entrusting to other power occurs, the person attains birth in the land of true fulfillment. The primal vow was established out of deep compassion for us who cannot become freed from the bondage of birth and death through any religious practice due to the abundance of blind passion. Since its basic intention is to effect the enlightenment of such an evil one, the evil person who is led to true entrusting by other power is the person who attains birth in the Pure Land. Thus, even the good person attains birth, how much more so the evil person? It is the person who is deeply conscious of their own evil who is able to really just give up the self and be deeply grateful that there is more than just the self. Another passage is this. The saying of Nembutsu is neither a religious practice nor a good act, since it is practiced without any calculation. It is a non-practice. Since it is also not a good created by my calculation, it is non-good. Since it is nothing but other power, completely free of self-power, it is neither religious practice nor a good act on the part of the practicer. It's totally unconditioned, is what he's saying. And then one last one sentence. The Master Shinran said, in the Nembutsu, no self-working is true working. It is beyond description, explanation, and conception. So really, even for the pious, really devotional schools that start to sound like Japanese versions of Martin Luther, they really talk about the unconditioned and totally letting go of self. I guess, you know, in Dogen's tradition, you talk about letting go of body and mind. Here we're talking about just a total letting go, even of that self, even the last little vestige of self-interest or self-will, and instead turning it over to total entrustment. Now I want to very briefly talk about Nichiren. He did not approve of this at all. He did not approve of the idea that you should throw out all of Buddhism, especially the Lotus Sutra. I have some quotes here. I'm not going to share them right now. I'm going to end this and at least have a few questions. Although he does say that in his teaching, there is no self-power, other power as such. There is no self-power because this self we think we have contains all beings in the universe, all the 10 realms, from the hells up to the Buddhas. But it's not other power either, because these Buddhas are already within ourselves. So there's a, if you look at things as this total interrelation where there is nothing graspable, how can you talk about self or other? This is one point Nichiren makes. Another point he makes is the virtue of the Daimoku. You know, people say, well, practicing the Lotus Sutra is hard. Calling upon Amida Buddha is easy. But Nichiren points out there are many passages in Lotus Sutra that says, you know, all the merit that, well, more merit than you can possibly imagine, he's saying, is contained in just even the name of the Lotus Sutra. Daimoku means sacred title. So he uses these kind of proof texts to show that this idea that the Lotus Sutra is hard is just bogus. You know, the Lotus Sutra, if you just go by these texts, and let's not even get into who actually wrote the text and where they came from, if you just go by the words of the text, the promise of the Lotus Sutra is just as grand, just as other power, if you will, as the Triple Pure Land Sutras. So to even think of the Dharma, to call upon the Dharma, to cherish and uphold the Dharma, even for a moment, the single moment of rejoicing the 10th chapter of Lotus Sutra talks about, is to attain the merit of awakening. He makes the argument a little more subtle than that, but I don't have time. And the last thing is, he talks about, you know, where is the Pure Land that we should try to be born into? I will read that quote. Let's see, 67, 68... Which Pure Land, question, which Pure Land should practicers of the Lotus Sutra pray to be reborn in? Answer, it is stated in the 16th chapter on the lifespan of the Buddha, the essence of the Lotus Sutra, consisting of 28 chapters, I will always stay in the Saha world. I reside here always, and this world of mine is at peace. Oh, by the way, this is from the verse section of chapter 16 of Lotus Sutra, which is recited in Soto Zen as well. According to these statements, the eternal true Buddha, the origin of all Buddhas and manifestation, is always in this Saha world. Then why should we wish to be anywhere other than this Saha world? You should know that there is no Pure Land other than the very place where the practicer of the Lotus Sutra resides. Why should we concern ourselves seeking a Pure Land in any other place? So that is why I think I find it kind of objectionable or misguided to lump Nichiren in with the Pure Land tradition, because I would say it's fairer to say he's a Tiantai reactionary, actually. I wouldn't object to that. I would say also that I think he goes beyond Tiantai in the later part of his teaching career, but that's a whole other talk. But Nichiren's not a Pure Land Buddhist. He's against the Pure Land. He's a Tiantai reactionary. He wants to return to that tradition that I was reading about before, about the four samadhis, and, you know, that the Pure Land is here with this mind, with this place, with what's going on here and now. Letting go doesn't have to be about devoting oneself to a Buddha in another world, another place, after death. So that's reducing very complex issues, maybe too simply, but I do want to make that stark contrast to kind of counter the kind of stuff you find in books like Buddhism for Dummies and other things, where they say, oh, Nichiren Buddhism is just a type of Pure Land Buddhism, and then they like go on to something else, or then they talk about Soka Gakkai. So anyway, so that's it. I tried to throw out as much as I could. I'm sorry, you know, if I was throwing you too many names and dates and going too fast. There's a lot more I wish I could have shared, but I do hope that I could have a little bit of time for questions, reflections. And with that, I will shut up and hand it over to you. Yes, Neil.
Is there any speculation that there might have been some interaction between Christianity and the Pure Land trends?
I've not read anything like that. I mean, certainly there's been a lot of dialogue recently, you know, especially when Protestant Christians read Shinran, they're like, holy crap, you know. When the Jesuits showed up in Japan, they felt that the devil had been there first, creating a counterfeit of Catholicism, because so many elements of Japanese Buddhism seemed like what they were doing. I do recall reading years ago some scholars suggesting that some aspects of Persian mystery religions might have been influencing Mahayana developments in Central Asia. You know, like the, what was that, Mitra. Yeah, I think it's Amitabha, Amitayas, Mitra. So that's probably more likely, like a Persian Central Asian influence than any direct influence by Christianity. And remember, you know, I was saying these Pure Land Sutras were being translated in China in the 2nd century. So these, at least a couple of those sutras I talked about, the Pratyutpana and the Sutra of the Buddha of Infinite Life, you know, they were early Mahayana sutras. I'm not even sure how Christianity would have even gotten into Central Asia at that point, other than maybe a stray merchant or two, or maybe Thomas showing up in India. But even then, that was further down. And I think most of this Pure Land stuff developed in Central Asia. Yes?
So my understanding in present Japan is the sort of akin here to the more Christian-dominant basis here in the United States. If you want to get married, if there's a funeral, something here to do with the family ceremony, then you go to a Pure Land priest. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Well, for funerals, yeah. For a wedding, you go to a fake Christian priest who's probably a student from the West teaching English as second language and dresses up as a priest. I'm not kidding. Yeah, so basically, Japanese people get born Shinto, they have sort of Shinto rite, get married Christian, and then die Buddhist. That's kind of the division of labor they've worked out currently. Mm. Yeah. Yes?
Well, that was all very interesting, but I find I'm also interested in what do you actually do when you go to church?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you mean as a Pure Land Buddhist?
Do you chant? Do you sit? What do you do?
Yeah.
capsule?
Right. I can tell you what Nichiren Shu Buddhists do. I've been to a couple of Pure Land services, and I've been to Chinese and Korean and...
What do you do in your own group?
Let's see. We basically start off with these hymns to welcome the Buddhas. By the way, this ceremony that I'm about to describe is a basic Sunday service. And the elements of it are derived from stuff in Tiantai's writings, like in the 6th century. So we start off with a hymn to basically welcome all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and to another hymn for taking refuge. And then there's a opening, I want to avoid the word prayer, but I guess invocation, saying, may all you beings be here and send us your compassion. Then after that would be the verses for opening the sutra. Same one you use. It's used throughout East Asian Buddhism. Although we've added to it. A priest in the 19th century added like a whole page to that first paragraph specific to the Lotus Sutra. And then we recite the beginning of the second chapter of the Lotus Sutra, which is about the 10 suchnesses. And that section on the suchnesses are recited 3 times to recognize the emptiness of all things, the provisional nature of all things, and the middle way of all things. Most Nichiren Buddhists don't know that's why we do it 3 times, but that's why. Then we recite the verses from chapter 16, which, by the way, are also recited in Soto Zen. I think Rinzai does, too. And it's also pretty universal in East Asia. After that, then we chant the Daimoku, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. At least in our tradition, we do it with a taiko drum, and people have hand drums that they beat, more or less following along with the taiko drum. Then after that, we might recite a passage from the 11th chapter of Lotus Sutra, where the Buddha congratulates people on upholding the sutra even for a moment. And then after that, there's a final dedication of merit, echo, just like you do here, except that it's longer. There are many different versions of it, too. I think the one we use was specifically written in America at some point decades ago. And then after that, we do the 4 great vows, which Tiantai Jerry is the one who popularized those based on some apocryphal Chinese sutras. And so now they're used throughout East Asia. And then Daimoku 3 times, and then we do another verse, kind of wishing the beings who came well and, they may now go on their way. And that's basically it. And if it were Pure Land Temple, they would recite passages in the Pure Land Sutras, and they're more sing-songy about it, too. You know, and they'll chant Nimbutsu instead of Daimoku, of course.
No place for sermon, for Dharma
talk? Oh, yeah, then there's a Dharma talk. Right, then there's a Dharma talk after. Exactly, yeah. And sometimes we do a practice instead of that kind of service called Shodagyo meditation, where we sit silently, mm-hmm. and then we chant Daimoku with the drum, first slow, then faster, 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 very fast, slow it down again, back into silence. And this silence, chanting silence, is preceded by vows, dedications, etc., but much shorter ones. Yeah.
So as you described it, it sounds like most of a service, of an enjoined right. service,
right.
would be a lot of chanting and a Dharma talk.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is in your practice, is there sitting meditation?
Yeah, well, as I just said, there's the Shodagyo meditation, which is sitting, silent sitting, chanting, silent sitting.
Okay.
First at San Jose, the first Sunday of the month, we have just sitting practice. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in fact, the first time I ever went down there, I was kind of surprised by this. And I said to the Venerable Yusho Matsudo, later became my sensei, you know, at the time, I said to him, I'm surprised you do sitting practice here. I thought Nichiren Buddhists only chanted. He gave me this look like, what? He said, of course we meditate. All Buddhists meditate. So that was his response to me.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, meditation's not as silent meditation is not as important in our school as the Daimoku chanting, which is itself considered meditation and observation of the mind, or kanjin. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you would not be together in the Sangha individually, would you also do a combination of sitting, meditation, and then maybe chanting?
You mean like home practice?
Yeah, home practice.
Well, that's basically up to the practitioner. Yeah, how they want to do it. I mean, they could just do a straight service, or they can just do sitting and chanting, or mm-hmm. do a service and incorporate sitting into it. It's really up to the practitioner. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes?
So I have a priestess friend who's a Pure Land priest as mm-hmm. well. She comes here every once in a while. She's coming here not too long from now. And it's kind of interesting. She explains the Pure Land just the way you just did, exactly.
Good.
Exactly. So, and I know that there's, you know, confusion probably, she says, even within her own community, yeah. you know, especially within the lay practitioner, but it's interesting that it's the same. But that was just more of a statement. My question kind of is about this. You said this thing about acquiring merit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. What about that?
I'm just wondering if you could
sure.
explain what...
Well, first of all, I'm glad to hear that I explained it the same way she did, because I don't, even though I'm not part of their school and my lineage is kind of in an adversarial relationship with them, I don't want to misrepresent them. And in fact, I have a lot of respect for Shinran, and even though it's supposedly adversarial, it's more of a collegial kind of thing now among all the school. We all get along now. But yeah, the merit thing. Well, you all know the story of Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu. Bodhidharma shows up in the court, and Emperor Wu says, look at all these temples I've built and things I've donated to the Sangha, and how much merit did this generate? And Bodhidharma says, none at all. There's a couple reasons it might be none at all. I think a shallow reason would be to say, well, you know, that kind of merit is insignificant next to the merit of comprehending the Dharma, or the merit, as the sutras constantly say, of upholding even a word or phrase of, pick your sutra, the Diamond Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, the Vimalakirti. They all have these little lines where they say, if you uphold this sutra even for a moment, even just a verse or a phrase, it's more merit than if you spent aeons, you know, practicing Dana Paramita, you know, giving clothing and food and medicine to the Sangha and practicing patience and precepts. It's more merit than that. So I think that's one way of looking at the no merit thing. It's like, it's insignificant.
Yeah.
The important thing is to get it. A deeper understanding, I think, would be to understand that merit is empty. No matter how much or how little of it supposedly there is, it's all empty. It's ungraspable. It's there, but not in a substantial way. And so don't get hung up on the idea of generating merit. And when I read the Lotus Sutras, chapter 16 is about how the Buddha's life really has no beginning or end. It's trying to kind of open your mind up about what the Buddha is, not just this historical guy or some figure in a fantasy land far away, but it is the endless and beginninglessness of awakening here and now. And that's chapter 16. Chapter 17, 18, and 19 are all about the great merit of accepting that and upholding that and passing that on. And they give these kind of comparisons. And when I read those chapters, you know, I try to understand that what's being talked of here is not the Buddha as some kind of God figure who is eternal, but the Buddha in his awakening essentially is empty, unconditioned. You can't talk about it in terms of birth or death, all these conceptual ideas. You have to just be there. Yeah. And that the merit generated from that is likewise inconceivable, ungraspable, incomparable to our usual ways of calculating things. You know, and that brings me back to why I really like Shinran, because I think he gets that, that there, you have to find a way to get away from the calculating mind, and then you start calculating about how to do that. Yeah. You know, so something else has to break in.
Yeah, it's that idea of calculating that I always want to hear, acquiring, generating. That's right. Like, those are the words that immediately are like, oh, now we have a bank account of merit.
Right, as long as you're caught up in that, you're caught. So how do you get out? Mm-hmm. And anything you do is just more of the trap. So something else has to break in or break through or whatever. How can you even say it?
Yeah. Right.
Thank you. Yeah. Anyone else?
It sounds like, you know, the influence here is on Pure Land as well as Zen has a, from my limited understanding, is also a very Taoist influence, saying the Tao is the Tao that cannot be named. It's, you know, talking about, well, it's the emptiness, it's no thought, it's beyond that, and yet it incorporates all of that.
Right. I was surprised when I was reading Shinran, how, and I forget, there's a specific Japanese phrase for it, but it translates as naturalness. And one of the things that comes up through this one's faith and Amida and entrusting is this naturalness, the ability to just be natural now. And, you know, it sounded like the ordinary mind Zen talks about. And so I realized that, yeah, that Taoist kind of influence or sensibility, at least, is here too, but it's in a different form. D.T. Suzuki, by the way, I have my problems with D.T. Suzuki, but, you know, he was also fascinated by Pure Land Buddhism and Shinran and wrote about that as well as Zen. People don't realize that, but, you know, there's a little thin volume about his writings on Pure Land. I don't think he presented it quite the way it should have been from a strictly Jodo Shinshu or Shinran school point of view. You know, it's very much with his Renzai kind of look at everything. But, you know, Suzuki also appreciated, D.T. Suzuki also appreciated that element of Pure Land Buddhism, you know, this kind of naturalness and letting go and letting the essential nature of mind take over. Yeah. So one more after that, or that was it?
As you like.
Oh, well, I'll take one more from someone else. Yes? No? Okay.
When I was in Bodh Gaya recently, there were lots of people doing lots of devotional practices. The Tibetans were doing 100,000 prostrations. But there were some Nichiren people there that... Every morning began with them walking through the streets, banging a drum, chanting.
Yeah.
What would they have been chanting? Do you know?
Well, they would have been chanting Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, but in a more singing kind of way.
Yeah. That was.
How do they do that? That's the Nipponzan Myoho Ji, by the way. They're kind of an offshoot of Nichiren Shu.
Okay.
And we all get along very well, stay at each other's temples and such. And, what is it? They beat the drum like. Something like that. It's I can't do it right now, but it's a specific beat. Yeah, they kind of go over each other like that. It's very nice.
It was nice.
Yeah. It's been a couple of years since I had a chance to do it with them. I actually marched with them a couple of times, like from like New Jersey into Manhattan. For one of the memorials for 9/11. Yeah, that was very nice. And then I stayed at their monastery in Peace Pagoda in Amherst, Massachusetts a couple times. And it's always a pleasure to get to walk and chant with them. Yeah, very sweet people. Yeah. All right, well, thank you all very much. And,
may our intention deeply extend to everyone.